Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Recently someone asked me a question. What is the best kind of meditation to do at the time of death? So this is a topic for tonight's talk. And it's a very good question, but it begs a question to start with. And it presupposes that we have the ability to control our mind so that we can choose what we're going to be doing at the time of our death. What's the best meditation to do at the time of death? So we're going to be in circumstances where we can think about that, and then that we have the ability to control our mind and just choose what we want to think about at that time. And of course, our experience in life is that even when we're not at death's door, it's very difficult to control the mind most of the time. And just when we're sitting here trying to meditate for half an hour, the mind wanders all over the place, and we bring it back to the breath, we bring it back into the body, we try to focus on the here and now, but it still wanders away. And so this is the first point to remember, and the first part of the answer to the question is that we have to train the mind in our life right now, start work if we're going to hope to be able to take control of the mind so that we can choose what kind of meditation will be most helpful to us at the time of death. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Buddhist attitude to death, and how this could possibly be something that we prepare for and we work on with our meditation, the Buddhist approach is that the time of the way that we die, the last thought moment, is very important because it culminates in not only the end of this life, but also the beginning of a new life. It leads on to that, the last moment of this life. And so it's important from two angles, how we leave this life, but also what kind of birth it will condition, will bring about. And so we practice consciously with the understanding that we are going to die, and that that time is an important time, and that there are practices that we can do to assist us at that time to die more peacefully and to produce the conditions for a favorable rebirth. But in fact, when we look at Buddha's path of practice and that understanding that life is impermanent and will certainly one day end in death, we understand that the whole of our life and the way that we live our life is not only practice for living, but practice for dying. Because the way that we cope with our death will be a result of the way that we've lived our life. And so when we're focusing on what is the best kind of meditation to do at the time of death, it's not separate from what is the kind of meditation that will help me to live my life more fully, to have a rich life, a life which is going to be fulfilling here and now, not just waiting for the end of this life. And the Buddha said, for those who don't believe that there's another birth, another life after this one, the things that are followed as path of the practice lead to happiness here and now without having to wait for another life. And those things which are practiced that lead to happiness here and now, if there is a future life, will certainly support that being a good life. A good life here and now, a good life in the future. So when we're talking about the best meditations to do at the time of death, first of all, we understand that we have to work now. It's no good waiting until the time of death, but also that whatever work we do is going to be beneficial for our life here and now. When we're looking at the variety of practices and the variety of meditations, how we decide which ones are most useful for us is by looking at our own predispositions, our own personality, our own tendencies in the way that we live our life right now, so that we become, if you like, our own diagnostician to see what kind of medicine we need to practice in order to be happy here and now. Where are the places that we get stuck in our life here and now? Where are the places, or what are the things that stir us up here and now? Because they're the very places, the very things that are going to be stirring us up at the time of death. And so that's how we start to work out what kind of practice is going to be most beneficial for us. Just to look at the variety of practices, we'll be all looking maybe at the same practice but for different reasons. So for example, the practice of loving kindness. We might look at ourselves and we realize that loving kindness is something that we have an affinity with. We like that practice, and it becomes something that we are drawn towards. And as we practice it, we see that it's something that we can do, that it gives us a lot of comfort. And so for that reason, we take up loving kindness practice as one of our major focuses. But on the other hand, we might realize that we've got lots of ill will and we easily get irritated and distressed when things or people don't do what we want. And because of that, because we realize this is something that I really need to work on, we take up loving kindness as a practice. So the point is that we have to know our own tendencies to be able to see what will be really helpful. Because if we just do it because someone else tells us to do it, without feeling a real connection to it, then we may do it following lots of shoulds, with a sort of artificial attitude towards what we should be doing, without appreciating or gaining the full benefit from the practice. So in loving kindness practice, we're trying to get in touch with a feeling in our own heart of warmth, of softness, of goodwill towards ourselves and towards other beings. And gradually extend the circle of goodwill beyond just those people that we like and that we have contact with in a pleasant way, to include people that we don't like, people that we don't know personally, and people who, when we think of them, we don't feel any warmth towards at all. And we may find that we have difficulty generating a feeling of goodwill towards ourselves even. So that's something we start to recognize as an insight. Gee, there's an absence of warmth, warm-heartedness in my life. And that's something that makes for a very dry, often miserable state of being. And so for my own benefit and for the sake of others, that's a practice that can be helpful. And as we try to get in touch with this warm-heartedness in our own heart and then extend it towards others, we do particular practices to come in contact, in touch with that feeling. And even if we find it's hard going, we persist with it because the fact that it's hard going is an even stronger indication that it's something that we need to do. And as we practice it, we gradually, through our persistence, start to recognize its benefits for ourselves and how it flows over into our relationships with others. And this is about making our own life sweeter right here and now. But how does that help us at the time of death, we might say? Well, for many different perspectives. Because one of the things that we struggle with at the time of death is leaving behind the things that we hold dear, the people that we hold dear. Our attachment to our loved ones, our attachment to the things which we take to be mine, is a source of pain, a source of great sorrow. We might be stuck in that difficulty trying to hang on when we're coming to a crunch time in our life. But one of the benefits of practicing loving kindness, as I said, is that we extend the range of our warmth and our concern beyond just the people who are close to us. And the result of starting to break down those boundaries and not be spending so much of our emotional and mental energy on just a few people is that by extending those boundaries, we make our own heart stronger. And because we make our own heart stronger, we become less dependent on just those few relationships to make us feel happy and secure. We start to find warmth in other people. We start to get strength from other relationships. We start to feel that we've got a firmer basis for good relationships in this life. And so our attachment to that small group of people that were formerly our whole world, that were the barometer of whether we were happy or sad, whether we felt secure and it had a place in the world, those attachments start to weaken, to loosen. Obviously not to disappear completely, but we don't feel that our whole life is bound up in just these few people. And because we're able to loosen those attachments and extend our goodwill further afield, at the time of death it can be very, very helpful, because it allows us not to be so caught in that very strong sense of being forced to leave behind that which we hold so dearly, hold on to so dearly, so tightly, that we fight against the inevitable. And because we have already extended our circle of goodwill, or our feeling of goodwill, to a much wider circle, we can find comfort in a situation where we mightn't have the people that we love with us at that time. We can find some connection to the people who are with us, who are helping us at this time. Now, this is quite significant in a situation where we're in an emergency and we may be wheeled into, for example, the emergency department of a big hospital, and we may be on a trolley in the hallway being attended to by people that we don't know. And they're the people who are trying to help us, trying to save our life. Now, if you've been in that sort of situation and you see the how frantic that kind of environment is, you also know that very often when you go into that sort of situation and you have maybe not so much an accident situation, but a life-threatening illness or something happening, maybe perhaps a heart attack coming or something like that, that you may be left on your trolley while various tests are being carried out. People are rushing here and there, doing this and that. You don't know what's going on. And in that situation, if you haven't got any connection to those people, if you haven't established that feeling of warmth and goodwill in your heart, it's very easy to get irritated, not only because you're frightened, but because you're not getting the attention you think you should get, or you don't understand what's going on, and you're focusing so much on me and mine. And the understanding that these people are actually doing something, doing their best to look after you, is completely missing because of the fear, because of the anxiety. And so it's actually very helpful, and this is speaking from the experience of seeing how people have used their meditation practice on loving kindness, and having been in that situation to hear how they've managed. At that time when there was tremendous fear for their own safety and a recognition that they were starting to get overwhelmed with that fear, or overwhelmed with the irritation or the worry, well, who's looking after me? What are they doing? What's going to happen next? Instead of getting lost in that kind of emotion, getting lost in those kinds of thoughts, which were actually making them more stressed, making them more anxious, they were able at that time to focus on the feeling of loving kindness and to reflect these people who I don't even know are doing their very best to look after me. These people who I don't even know are doing all they can to keep me alive. So instead of fighting them and fighting the situation, what can I do to help them? What can I do to appreciate them? What can I do to support them in the work that they're doing? And so, going into that feeling of loving kindness, being able to extend loving kindness to the people working to help, very beneficial at that time. But soothing one's own mind, helping to bring the mind to a point where it can focus on the present moment, but focus in the most beneficial way. Instead of focusing on who's not here, focusing on who's present. Instead of running to the future, what's going to happen next? What are they doing now? Focusing on the present moment, what's happening now, what's being done right now. And obviously in a traumatic situation like that, there's still going to be fear, anxiety, but that goes into the background as the loving feeling, the warm feeling, the feeling of connectedness to these people who are doing their best to help comes to the foreground. And that becomes the place where you find comfort. That becomes the place where you can rest and let go. But of course, to be able to do this, you can't do it unless you've practiced. Unless you've practiced throughout your life and practiced in the situations which weren't so traumatic, but which were challenging nonetheless. So working with perhaps people at work that you find difficulty with, working in those uncomfortable situations that you might meet day after day and which aren't easily overcome, but which you have to be patiently, persistently working with, then you build up the strength of the mind and you also develop a confidence that this practice works. That confidence in the practice is really important because that becomes the key to finding refuge in even the most traumatic situation. So loving kindness and the development of loving kindness is just one of these
advice. People are actually telling me
you have to know.
Where I go very often. Sometimes some of the Buddhists there, on their deathbed, they may have one child who's been converted by one of these born-again Christian groups. And they bring their pastor and all their friends around to try and convert their grandfather on their deathbed. Because this is their last chance to get their grandfather to heaven, otherwise he's going to burn in hell forever and ever and ever. Sure, they're sincere. Just like Hitler was sincere. He thought he was doing the right thing too. Sincerity is no guarantee of morality.
Qualities. And so it's beneficial if you have that kind of connection to the Buddha as your teacher, perhaps connection to some of the great disciples of the Buddha, that you learn some chants and you learn them by heart. So you have them at your fingertips. You can bring them into your mind. You can recite them, even when you're in a really difficult situation. And those words, the particular words, the particular feeling that they evoke, can bring great comfort, even in the midst of trauma. So recently someone was telling me that they were in the midst of an emergency situation. And all they could remember was homage to the Blessed One, the perfectly enlightened one. homage to the Blessed One, perfectly enlightened. And they just repeated that again and again. And after they'd repeated it again and again, then they were able to remember the words for taking refuge. Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dhammang saranang gacchami, Sanghang saranang gacchami. And they just repeated that over and over. And then they went back to saying in English, homage to the Blessed One, fully enlightened. That was all they could do at the time. But they found great comfort in that. And as they found great comfort, they started to calm down. And that was their refuge. Their connection to the Buddha as their teacher and the fact that they've used their life as well as they could to follow in the Buddha's footsteps. And we're talking about not just an intellectual connection, but a heart connection. And that heart connection can only be developed through practice. It's not something that someone else gives to us. It has to come from within us. And so, even with the breath meditation, tonight I mentioned that as we experience the stillness of the mind, we start to access that pleasant feeling from within the mind itself. And so breath meditation may be the thing that gives you most comfort when you're at the time of death. Most comfort because you've practiced it again and again. And even if you haven't come to the point of experiencing deep absorptions, the jhanas, you've become so familiar with the breath and so familiar with that feeling of connectedness just to this moment, just to this breath, connected to the stillness of the mind, not moving away to the next moment, but staying right here, not moving away to what if, not letting fear or anxiety drive the mind away from this stillness, this peace. You've become so familiar with that that you can access it. When you can't do anything else, when you can't manipulate the situation, when all you can do is just hang on to the next breath and let go. You've practiced that, you've experienced it, you know that it does bring comfort, and so that's what you do when you can't do anything else. And very often when we're in a situation of trauma, we can't do anything but let everyone else do what needs to be done. There's nothing more that we can do with this body. We can't get up and leave. We just have to be there. We just have to bear with. And so just taking up the breath can provide us with that refuge. The refuge which allows us to cooperate with those people who are helping us at that time. These practices sound very simple, and it may sound simplistic, but they actually are our lifeline. The lifeline to this moment and whatever it is that we're experiencing, but also the connection to the next moment, so that we enter the next moment more peacefully, with more stability of mind. But they have to be practiced and developed right now. Sometimes we can find great comfort in the celebration of our own goodness. And this is something which the Buddha encouraged us to develop to remember the good things that we've done and to reflect on them and allow them to fill the mind with joy. And that joy becomes energy for the mind, becomes a source of strength. And the Buddha encouraged us to develop the ability to focus more and more on the good things we've done and less on the unskillful things that we've done or not done in this life. So as we come to that moment of death, which is going to come up into our mind? Is our mind going to be filled with, oh no, I never got to do this or that. Oh no, I've wasted this life by spending it in unskillful ways. Or are we going to be able to let those things subside? And are we going to be able to find something to rejoice in, to recollect and to say, well, I did the best I could while I had the chance? Now we can see if when I ask you to think of something today that you've done or this week that you've done that's a source of joy as you reflect on it, whether you've got anything to bring up. And if you have got something to bring up, how easy is it to do that? Or do you say, oh, that's not really very good, or I shouldn't think that, or gee, I can't think of a damn thing, you know? It's actually a practice to start to develop the ability to find those things in our mind, in our life, and bring them up easily. Recently I taught a weekend retreat, and before each session I read out some sentences and invited people to observe the reaction in the mind when they heard these sentences. And I'll just read them for you, a couple of them, so you can observe the feeling in your mind as I read them out to you. Just seeing your attitude to your own goodness. If this day or in the past I have done good deeds to other beings with body, speech or mind, whether greatly or only little, for the happiness of others, or through desire for the training, or respect for the Triple Gem, I here and now, before the Buddha, call to mind those deeds and let my heart rejoice. I rejoice in my own good deeds, resolving not to compare myself with others. I rejoice in my own good deeds and gladly share my joy with all beings everywhere. I rejoice in my own good deeds, allowing this joy to further purify my heart. May my good deeds and the merit that comes from them help in the freeing of the heart. Now some of us have a great difficulty thinking of the good deeds that we've done and bringing them to mind easily. And again, someone was telling me that when they were doing this practice during the retreat, it was hard work. They almost cringe trying to think of things that they've done that are good. And because they have what they call a problematic relationship with other people, they looked into their mind and they could feel that cringe as they tried to access their good deeds. And they said they couldn't bear to look at their relationship with other people, but they were able to remember a kindness that they'd done to an animal. They remembered how they'd rescued an animal that had been abandoned. And this animal was distraught because it was lost and abandoned. And then they remembered how when they had shown some kindness to this animal and taken it in, just the look, first of fear and then of appreciation on that animal's face, was something which they said at that time actually brought tears to their eyes. And so they went back to that experience and they remembered it and they visualized that animal and they remembered how they felt at being able to show some kindness to this wretched animal. And they said every time they heard the verses, they went back just to that. And over the weekend, they said that actually created a little chink in their wall. A little bit of light started to come in, a little bit of warmth in their own heart. And gradually they could start to recollect some of the other good things that they'd done, not just to animals, but to human beings. Now, this is a good example of how we need to develop these practices. In a meditation retreat where we're doing more intensive practice, it took a whole weekend for that person to be able to move from the very, very beginning of something to being able to develop it and see that it was actually beneficial for them. And the very fact that they couldn't rejoice in their own good deeds was an indication of that's a place that it would be helpful if they could do some work. And they said that afterwards, they realized this was a place that they needed to do some work, but it was so difficult that they hadn't been able to tackle it up until then. It was only because we were in the meditation retreat situation that they were game to have a go. Now, if we're facing our death and we're in a situation where we're on our own, perhaps as a result of someone else's behaviour, and we have a lot of fear but also anger or irritation arising in the mind, and we know that this isn't beneficial for ourselves. If we can bring to mind those good deeds, if we've cultivated that awareness and that heart connection with that feeling of having spent our life well, that can bring not only comfort but refuge for the mind. But we have to be able to access that when it's easy and when it's difficult. And that's why we need to practice it. And if we're aware of the fact that whenever we think about ourselves, we always think in the negative. We always hone in on the things that we've done badly instead of on the things that have gone well, then this is one area of our life that we need to do some work with. One of the similes that's given for the way that the mind at the time of death is affected by the thoughts that come up, what kind of thought comes up, is the simile of cows in a barn, cattle in a barn. It's said that if we've done something really strongly, good or bad in our life, that's like a bull in the herd. And when those cattle are in the barn and the door is open, then the bull is going to go out and lead the herd. These really strong good deeds or bad deeds the bad deeds are really bad, like killing one's mother and one's father, harming a Buddha, killing an Arahant. These sorts of things probably no one has done, and we don't have the opportunity to do the very strong good deeds like feeding the Buddha at the head of the Sangha, although we have the opportunity to do lots of other good deeds. But it's unlikely that we have any bulls in our herd, those really strong negative ones or really strong positive ones. But the next category of deeds or thoughts that are likely to come are thoughts connected with very strong but not quite so strong positive or negative deeds that we've done in our life. So if we've been keeping the five precepts and trying to live a good life, and that has been the direction that our life has been heading in, and so we've been generally generous, generally helpful, and then we've taken the opportunity to do things that have been of service, that have been uplifting. Those are the sorts of very strong good deeds which are likely to come to mind. And that's like the strongest cow in the herd. After the bull, it's that strong cow that leads the barn. So particularly if we've been not only doing good things every now and again, but making it a part of our lifestyle, those things are likely to lead our thoughts at the time of death. So particularly practicing meditation and developing any of these practices, these create very strong impressions in the mind. And they're the things which are likely to come to the forefront of the mind at the time of death. After the strongest cow, there is, if there's no bull and there's no really big cow, then the cattle in the barn will be led out by whoever's the usual leader. They may not be the biggest or the strongest, but they're the one that usually goes first. And this is like our habit patterns, the things that we create in our life, the things that we do again and again, but also our particular personality traits. So if we're a person who always runs off into the future or always runs off into worry, they're the sort of habits which are likely to lead our mind at the time of death. And so again, it's important that we start to get to know ourselves. We start to get to know what are the things that my mind usually runs to, and what are the things that I need to do to counteract that tendency if it's not skillful. So we might be anticipating a holiday, but we might be just full of worry and fear, always imagining the worst things that are going to happen in our holiday. We can't even enjoy it. And not only can't we enjoy it when we're there, we're being miserable about it before we've even taken off. Right now we're miserable, thinking about how bad it's going to be, and we haven't even done it yet. So we start to see, not only the mind running off to the future, but running to the miserable side of things. Now, if that's our habit pattern in life, that's likely to be what comes up at the time of death. We have no thought, I might be going to the heaven realms. That'll be lovely. We imagine it's the worst kind of thing. And because we haven't counteracted that tendency, because it's a strong habit, if there's nothing else there, it can easily be the leader of the herd. So we start to get to know ourselves right now, and then we start to do the practice that will most counteract those unhelpful habits in the mind. When we're practicing the breath meditation, we're not only learning that stillness gives rise to a pleasant feeling. But until we get to that point, we start to get familiar with where the mind wanders to when it's not staying with the breath. It's only natural that it will wander, but most of the time we're unaware of those ruts in the mind, those ruts which take the mind again and again back to the same old places, to the future, to worry, to the future with anticipation, to the past with regret, to the past with resentment. Just practicing the breath meditation helps us to become familiar with our mind, and then we can diagnose what we need to do to help the mind to stay in the present moment, but to stay with a pleasant feeling. And so practicing breath meditation supports practicing loving kindness meditation. Practicing loving kindness meditation helps us to practice breath meditation. So we're not saying that there is one thing we need to do. It will always be a combination of practices. The overall aim that we have is to help the mind to be energetic, to be skillful, to use experience in a way that allows us to see more clearly our own personality, see more clearly and understand the nature of the mind, and then use that understanding and use that base of strength of mind to be in each moment with more energy, more buoyancy, more clarity, more ease. So we're creating the conditions to be able to find refuge in each moment. The moments when we lose the balance of the mind because things are so good, or the moments when we lose the balance of the mind because they're so hard, and all the moments in between when we're just not aware of what's going on because of our sloppiness of mind, mindfulness, our unawareness. So we're sharpening up our mind so that when we get to a really difficult situation, such as trauma, emergency, crisis, that we will be able to use our mind, have our mind as our ally, have those assets which we've cultivated through the course of our life there to support us at that time. We may not have anyone else that we know with us, but we will always have ourselves. We will always have our mind. And whether the people that are with us are known to us or not, we can, through our practice, maximize the benefit that we can gain from those people, even if they're not people that we know personally, through working with our own state of mind. So just to recap, unless we practice in this life, we won't be in a position to decide what kind of meditation we'll be doing at the time of our death. The way that we develop these skills is throughout this life, not waiting until matters get serious. And what we develop depends on our own personality, our own predispositions. We have to find out for ourselves what we need to do, how to do it, and then we have to patiently and persistently practice it over time. When we do that, the meditation starts to develop. We find aspects of it revealing themselves that we could have never known just by hearing about it in theory. Until we do it ourselves, we won't realize what it has to offer us, and we won't know whatever else we need to do to support ourselves, not only to die peacefully, but also to live happily. So please take a look at your own life, at your own mind, so that you can use this human birth to the maximum, to make best use of this wonderful teaching which we have, which is benefits us here and now, but also in the future. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of us, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. Are there any questions or comments? So the question is, what if you don't want rebirth? Is there a choice? According to the Buddha's teaching, we are making a choice constantly. This is actually interesting, again, to just reflect on in the light of the teaching. The practice that we're doing is removing the conditions for rebirth. The choice is not up to us in the final moment, if you like, because while we've still got fuel for the fire will still burn. So the desire to be, the craving to be, is the fire that's burning, and all our desires and our actions to fulfill those desires throughout this life adds fuel to the fire. At the time of death, it's not a matter of just deciding not to have that. We can't just put out the fire while it's burning so very strongly. So until enlightenment, where the desire for life, for rebirth, is completely removed, there will always be rebirth, whether we like it or not. So what we're doing in this life is starting little by little to remove the fuel for the fire that is burning right in this moment. And by removing the fuel and not putting new fuel on, we gradually that fire burns down. And then at the time of death, desire for a new existence is no longer there. Now we take off the fuel by starting to become familiar with this impulse, this craving in the mind, which is constantly trying to manipulate conditions of our life to be the way we want them to be, for things to be according to our desires, for people to be the way we want them to be, all of those things. And as we start to understand that, we see that the suffering that we feel, the unsatisfactoriness we feel in life, is because we can't organize life to follow our wishes and our commands. And by starting to realize that, we no longer try to manipulate things so much. And we learn to then be at peace, more at peace with life. And being more at peace with life is accepting that this life will come to an end. This body will one day wear out. But the mind, whatever it still has that desire in it for existence, will take rebirth somewhere else. As we practice in this life to become more familiar with this and more aware of it, the time of death is a very powerful time to actually see more deeply into this wisdom aspect of the Buddha's teaching. So one of the wisdom aspects is to know that, yes, everything is impermanent and that this body doesn't belong to me. At the time of death, when our body is ceasing to function, it's not supporting life in the way it was, it's not doing what we want it to do, we see we don't have control over it, that is a time that is really powerful for us to see the truth of the Buddha's teaching. So if we have prepared the mind, it's possible that at the time of death we can develop very profound insight into reality. That can be the time when we wake up, because the truth of the teaching is right in our face. So obviously, if our mind is running off to the future or full of regret or worrying because we have to leave behind all that we've worked so hard for, if our mind is full of those kinds of emotions, there's no way that we're going to be able to have the clarity and the precision to observe what's actually going on and to develop insight at that time. But if we've steadied our mind, if we're able to be in the present and with that strength of mind stay with what's happening, then there's a possibility at the time of our death that we'll really see the truth of the teaching and in that moment be able to let go really deeply. And that's the other reason why it's so important if we have the aspiration to attain complete freedom, that we practice in this life so the time of death can be used for our spiritual growth. And then death becomes not something that shouldn't happen or that we fight against. It becomes another moment for deep practice. So we can face our death with a sense of excitement almost. Wonder, oh wow, this is a time that's really going to be fruitful. We work up to it with how we do our practice right now. So the short answer is no, we can't just choose not to come back unless we've done the work necessary, produced the causes and conditions. Then there's every possibility that we may be able to, at the time of death, use it for our profound spiritual awakening.